You might open up your Bibles to 1 Corinthians chapter 1. 1 Corinthians chapter 1. We're going to continue our study through the book of 1 Corinthians tonight. You know, in our society, we have become very accustomed to seeing the image of the cross. In fact, just today I was reading a story about a small town outside of Indianapolis called Kingstown, Indiana, where the ACLU is suing the city because they have a Christmas tree, which traditionally they've had a cross on top of the Christmas tree, and there's a man that says that the image of the cross causes him irreparable harm because he has to drive by that every day and see that. And I know that must be painful. But you know, when you talk about the cross, I think what Paul says here in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, in verse 18, the word of the cross is folly or foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. We have become very accustomed to seeing the cross. I don't know if you have seen the ads on TV for the MyPillow.com, the pillow that's so expensive, but you're going to get the best night's sleep ever. But the guy that is pushing down the pillow the whole time he's talking has a big old cross right around his neck. I've noticed that every time I've seen that crazy commercial. And he's wearing that because he wants to make a point, I'm sure, but that's because he is part of a group that traditionally does that. And it's not uncommon for people to wear jewelry that's in the image of the cross. And as you drive down the highway, you're going to see the cross on top of church buildings. You'll see it certainly in yards right now, and people will be really sanitized kind of toward that because the cross has become kind of sanitized in our mind. So what Paul is saying, I don't think we can really relate to the way that they think about the cross in the first century, because it's become something that's just part of our culture, that we see it all the time. So I want to suggest that we might consider a way to think about this in the way that they did in the first century. Because what the cross meant in the first century was a form of punishment. And that's what they thought about when they thought of the cross. And so you consider capital punishment today and how capital punishment is carried out. Let's consider it in that regard. Today, if I'm correct, 33 states use lethal injection as the means for capital punishment for crimes that would dictate that. The electric chair is used in 8 states. Gas chamber is used in 5 states. So can you imagine driving down the road and you see large statues of gas chambers, or you see statues of electric chair, or somebody is wearing an electric chair and on a chain around their neck, or you see that an electric chair or a gas chamber is the focal point of somebody's worship when they come together. You know, you wouldn't think you would see people wearing jewelry that had the image of a needle used for lethal injection. But I know that sounds repulsive to us, but this is the kind of repulsion that those in the first century would have had toward the cross. The cross was something that was not something they wanted to think about. The cross was not hopeful. It was not joyful. It was not sanitized. It was deplorable. It was despicable. And to many, Paul said it seemed to be foolishness. The cross was something that a lot of people didn't want to talk about because it was shameful. It was a shameful way of dying. And it's not something that you would want to use to proclaim a message of hope about a person who was executed in that way. It's much similar to what we would think today about death by lethal injection, a gas chamber, or electrocution. That doesn't usually represent a message of hope. So I think this is the culture, this is the issue that Paul is dealing with here. When people think about the cross, they don't see it like we do. When we see the cross, we think about hope. We think about sacrifice. It represents to us what Jesus did for us. And I'm not trying to change our thinking about what we see when we see the cross, but I want you to get the picture of what Paul is dealing with in that society when he says that the word of the cross is folly to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. So there's two different ways of looking at the cross. He said, for most people, it's not good. But for us who are being saved, it represents something very good. I believe that's what it represents to most people today when they see the cross. It represents the power of God. It represents a message of what, you know, Jesus has done for us. So when Paul is declaring this, he's living in a world or a society where, as we've already said, slick presentation is something that is very much admired. The person that is an accomplished orator, a great speaker, that is something that really reigns supreme in that society. But Paul is making a dividing line here. He's saying that is not what you need to be looking at. This is not what is important, is how powerful or how polished a speaker can be. And so he quotes back from Isaiah chapter 29. If you would just turn over there real quick and keep your finger in 1 Corinthians as well, because we'll be coming back there. But in Isaiah chapter 29, Paul quotes from here in verse 14. He says, therefore, behold, I will again do wonderful things with this people with wonder upon wonder, and the wisdom of their wise men shall perish, and the discernment of their discerning men shall be hidden. So the point here is that those who think they're going to be wise are going to be shown to be foolish. And so that is exactly what is happening in Corinth. If you back up just a couple of verses, this is a context in Isaiah that presents a people who don't really desire to see God. And Paul is dealing with that too in the Corinthian society. Verses 11 and 12, and the vision of all this has become to you like words of a book that is sealed. When men give it to one who can read, saying, read this, he says, I cannot, for it is sealed. And when they give the book to one who cannot read, saying, read this, he says, I cannot read. So the idea there is that these are people that don't want to learn, they don't want to see. And God declared that these types of people are the ones that draw near to Him with their lips, but their hearts are far from Him, in verse 13. So what was God going to do? Well, He was going to destroy the wisdom of the wise. He was going to do away with the discernment that those who thought they were discerning had, that they really didn't. So the point that Paul's making in 1 Corinthians chapter 1 is that the cross is God's way of doing exactly what He had promised in Isaiah what He was going to do. That this was going to make men look foolish. That the cross of God is destroying all human pretensions that they are strong and that they are wise and that they are central to everything. Really, the cross is the central theme of the Scriptures, or central focal point, that God will destroy everything that humans like to depend on for strength, if it's not Him, and that they're going to have to depend on Him for salvation. The problem is that many of us are self-centered. Many people are they glorify themselves to such a point that they may even think that they can outsmart God, as if God owes us explanations. We act as if we are wise and that God exists only to meet our needs. You know, some have used the expression that some people treat God like Santa Claus, that they just are going to give Him a list of things that they want. I want this, I want this, I want this. And they don't respect God for who He is. You know, some people look at the gospel and think, well, this is a book of great advice. This is a great book of wisdom, or a good devotional book. You know, good thoughts to think on. But they don't get past that. The gospel is not just some good advice. It is the good news of the gospel of salvation. And the gospel is God's power for those who believe. The gospel is the place where God has destroyed all human arrogance at the cross. And so that's what Paul is saying about the cross. That's what it represents. And it really destroys human wisdom. And so the first part of the section that we're going to look at tonight, number one, is Paul is dealing with destroying false systems. If you look in verse 20 and verse 21. Where is the one who is wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God the world did not know God through wisdom, it pleased God through the folly of what we preach to save those who believe. And so here in this section, God asks three rhetorical questions. Where is the one who is wise? And if people are on to what Paul is saying, nobody in the audience needs to raise their hand. Well, it's me. That's not the right answer. When Paul speaks about wisdom here, he's not referring to like the wisdom in the Proverbs. He's referring to wisdom as it had meaning to the Corinthians. And the way that the Corinthians thought about wisdom in their society was that it was part of a public philosophy and they had this articulated worldview that tried to make sense out of life. And you know, you can't help but think about a lot of the foolishness in the world today and the things that people try to do to explain the world and keep God out of the picture. As if, you know, they're so wise that they can come up with everything themselves and explain everything without including God in that. But that's what we have here. The wise man was the one who could adopt and articulate and defend the world views of the day. And we see that certainly today. I can't help but think about the election and all of the talking heads and the pundits that had their theories about how things were going to play out. And I watched a few minutes of that. And what's funny is that there are so many people that are very articulate that were talking about these things. And, you know, if I were trying to debate them or talk to them, they would talk circles around me. I mean, just the things that they could think of and the arguments that they made, and they laid out how everything was going to be in such a way, and that this candidate was certainly going to win. And then all of these people that thought that they were smart, you know, turned out not to be so smart. And it's not that they were really ever smart. It's just they were making hypothetical situations. They were trying to predict something that they really didn't have the power to predict. They didn't know what was going to happen, but they thought they knew. And sometimes people can say something in such a convincing way. It sounds so good coming out of their mouth that you believe them. And sometimes people that are in technical positions, an IT position, will say some things to a person that is not so technically inclined, and they'll explain it. And it doesn't make any sense at all. What they're saying is not true at all. I mean, you've heard sometimes people will say, well, you know, that was just the ID10T error. Oh, okay. And you write down ID10T and it's spelled idiot. Or it's a picnic error. And, you know, I use that sometimes when I was in IT, and I would tell some, you know, what was the problem with my computer? Oh, it's just a picnic error. Well, picnic meant problem in chair, not in computer. But so these kind of things, sometimes the person that doesn't understand what the acronym means, you could say that and not define it. It's just a picnic error. And, oh, okay, yeah, I'm glad you fixed it. And so I'm really making fun of them. They didn't know it. But the person that can say things and say sounds so good can get a point across and people believe them. And Paul was dealing with people in that day. There were people in Corinth that were very well known for their ability to speak. They were considered wise because what they said sounded good. And Paul is saying, all of these people that have your ear today, that sound good when they speak, they don't know what they're talking about. That God is making them foolish because their worldview is not right. They claim to make sense out of life and death and the universe. And to the Greeks, if you could explain life, then that meant, well, you're in control of life, but they're not really in control of it. The same is true today. So, those that are considered to be wise sometimes can't help you do a thing about your salvation. And so, Paul says, who is the one who is wise? He's saying that the ones who you think are wise are not really wise. The one who figured out that the cross means something, that the cross is the means of salvation, that's the one who's wise. The next question he asks is, who is the scribe? Some translations may say, where is the scholar? And that, you know, the rendering scholar might mislead you into thinking that suggests somebody that's an academic, but that's really not what's being addressed here. Paul is addressing the person who's considered to be an expert in the law, an expert in the law of God. And certainly there were a lot of those as well. Theologians, Bible experts, they are going to fare no better than the wise men because they're not grasping it either. They're not grasping the cross either. So those who are wise in the world, those who think that they're wise in the ways of religion and the law, if they're not grasping the cross, then they're not considered wise. Also, where is the scribe, where is the debater of this age? Many people were trained in rhetoric, and, you know, I'll just say that I've heard some debates from time to time. You know, listening to debates is not really one of my favorite things when it comes to religious debates, because I think the person that is considered the winner is the one who is the best speaker most of the time. But that doesn't mean that's the person that has the truth. And so you end up admiring the person who is the best speaker instead of understanding what the truth is. That's not always the case, but no matter how brilliant somebody may be able to lay out their argument, and I've heard people that they're absolutely wrong in what it is that they believe, but they lay it out in such a way that it sounds so beautiful to someone. Paul says, where is the debater? The one who can really spin a story to make you believe it, that person is not understanding what the cross is either. The point is that everything the world values is brought to nothing by the cross. God made the wisdom of the world and all that it deems valuable to be foolish. So that's what Paul's saying here. And he continues in verse 21 with this thought. For since in the wisdom of God, the world did not know God through wisdom, it pleased God through the folly of what we preach to save those who believe. So those who are in the world that are going to be foolish because they are depending on worldly wisdom, they don't have a knowledge of God. It's not bringing them, their knowledge is not bringing anybody closer to God. They really need to think about that. And today, everything that the world teaches in the realm of spirituality sometimes draws people closer to the world or closer to themselves. If it's not bringing them closer to God and the cross, it's really not valuable at all. And people talk about becoming one with the universe or doing meditation or becoming one with nature. You know, what does that mean? What does it accomplish? Paul says it doesn't accomplish anything. Nothing in the wisdom of the world brings you closer to God. More worldly wisdom may make you more popular. It may make people listen to you. It may give you a spot on some network news channel. But it's not bringing you closer to God. And choosing a worldview that's not consistent with the Scriptures is not going to make you closer to God. Creating spirituality by emphasizing health, saving the planet, being tolerant, or whatever, you know, is the trendy worldly motto you choose, is not helpful. And this is not new. Having people in the world that think that they have somehow figured out some things that are not in the Scriptures and that they are above, you know, what you know, foolish Christians are thinking, that they're on some other plane or some other level, that's not new. And God says that those who seek after worldly wisdom, the cross makes foolish. And so it really makes you consider how really idolatrous the wisdom of the world truly is. And the interesting thing is that verse 21 says that this is all by God's design. That this was in the wisdom of God to do this. It pleased God to do this, to save those who by His grace will abandon themselves or abandon their own wants and desires to trust in Him and rely on Him and put away their own wisdom, put away their own understanding or their own strength, that God becomes their center. God becomes the rock. God becomes the foundation, the anchor, or whatever the term you want to use, that means that we are attached to God and that we put everything else aside. And that's all by God's design. But He also wants us to understand those who are perishing. And He goes on in verse 22 and makes some statements about the Jews and the Gentiles and what some of their specific issues were. Verse 22, "For the Jews demand signs and the Greeks seek wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and folly to Gentiles, but to those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ the power of God and the wisdom of God. For the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men." So Paul divides the perishing into two groups, what the Jews demand and what the Greeks seek. And, you know, you may think, well, there may be more than two groups, but when you look at the things that they trusted in, really everybody falls into one of those things. Now you'll see that what both of these groups demand represents what every human does today as their basis for following or not following and submitting or not submitting to Christ. First of all, like I said, Jews demand signs. And you might recall when Jesus was alive, Jesus did a lot of signs. He did a lot of miracles, and often the Jews demanded Jesus to perform a sign for them while He was on the earth. Let's turn back to 1 Matthew chapter 12. And you know, the interesting thing is it was never enough. Jesus certainly had done things, and the witness of those who had seen these things certainly went forth. But it was never enough for those who didn't want to believe. Matthew chapter 12, verse 38. "Then some of the scribes and Pharisees answered Him, saying, 'Teacher, we wish to see a sign from you.' But He answered them, 'An evil and adulterous generation seeks for a sign, but no sign will be given to it except the sign of the prophet Jonah.'" And if you look in chapter 16, also in John chapter 4 and John chapter 6, you see similar accounts of this type of thing happening. So why was Jesus condemning them for seeking a sign? When you look at the Gospel of John, you see that these people were not asking for a display of God's power. They were wanting to put themselves in the driver's seat. So let me see a sign so I can test you, so I can evaluate you and test your claims. I'm going to decide if you are who you say that you are. Think about that for a minute. If they're demanding that Jesus does a sign so they can make some kind of decision about Him, who's in the driver's seat? You know, you've seen the bumper stickers, "God is my co-pilot." You know, well, He's not supposed to be the co-pilot. He's supposed to be the pilot. But, you know, in this situation, you know, God's not really the pilot at all. He's not in the driver's seat. These people that are doubting and wanting to see a sign are the ones who are. They put themselves in that position as a judge and as an evaluator, rather than recognizing that Jesus is God. Jesus is the judge. Jesus is the one who is the evaluator. He's not going to yield to their request, which, you know, in effect would have turned Jesus into some kind of performer. I'm going to perform on demand for you. You know, that was not what he was going to do. Also, it represents people today who reject God because they demand that God do something for them. If you, God, will do something for me, then I'll do something for you. I'll believe in you. I'll accept you. If you agree to these things that I'm stipulating, if you want the privilege of me following you, so God must do this for me. He needs to heal me. He needs to heal my family member. He needs to do something for me. He needs to fix my marriage. He needs to give me money. So God needs to do something for me so that I will follow Him. Doesn't that seem a little backwards? As if we are gods and God needs to do what we say, and therefore I'll do what God says if He'll do what I say? Also, Paul says, the Greeks seek wisdom. And this does not help create conditions for us to submit to God. Those that seek wisdom are not seeking the wisdom of God. They're seeking the wisdom of men. So they kind of create these structures of thought, you know, I can't help but think about some of the so-called scientists and people that are trusted today in regard to atheism and the creation of the universe, and hear them try to explain how the world was created. And they do this to try to explain life and explain the universe, and they do it in such a way and with such big words that people think that they know something. They kind of create these big old, you know, structures of thought to maintain this delusion that they know something. But, you know, they may be good in the academic field, and they may have some kind of philosophical attributes that other people admire. But they are so wrapped up in what they think and their theories that God, if He exists, He needs to fit into my philosophy. He needs to fit into my worldview if He's going to be acceptable to me. And sometimes there are those that open up the pages of the Bible and say, you know, this, you know, God should not have done this. I don't see how God could do such a thing. And, you know, my God would not, you know, send someone to hell. My God would not punish somebody. My God would not do this or that. And so again, you see where that places you. That places you above God, and that you know better than God. And so those that sought after wisdom would think that they are the ones that can put God in His place, and they can define who God is. So in both of these cases, you see how they're a little bit similar in the Jews and the Greeks. You know, the Jews saying, show us a sign so we can approve you. And then there's the Greeks that have their own wisdom, and they want to fit God into their little box. In both cases, it's like, I have the right to approve God. I'll determine if God is right for me and if He fits my view of life and if He fits my expectations. So what does Paul do? Paul's just going to push all that away. He's going to push all that aside, and he's going to preach Christ crucified. But he says it's a problem for both of you. It's a problem for both groups. But he says it's a stumbling block. In verse 23, he says,
For the Jews demand signs and Greeks seek wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and folly to the Gentiles.
So they both have problems with Christ and Him crucified. That's what the cross does to those who have these kind of thoughts. Again, the cross, to those who are called, is a display of the power of God and the wisdom of God. What's the answer for both groups? It's the same. Christ is the answer for both groups. The Jews needed to accept Christ, which many of them didn't want to do. Gentiles didn't want to do that. They considered all of it foolishness. But the power of God was on full display through the cross of Jesus. And the Greeks, desiring wisdom, they're given Christ, who is the wisdom of God on full display. So if they really want true wisdom, there it is. And the cross of Christ is a great display of God's wisdom. When the world is rebellious and self-centered, it needs the cross. And when the world dismisses God as foolishness, they're dismissing something that's so much greater than human wisdom. What the world writes off as hopeless weakness, God proves is really strong. That's the way a lot of the world sees those who believe in God. Well, you have to believe in a higher power because you're so weak, you can't survive without it. And that's the way a lot of people describe religion. That's the way they describe a dependence on a higher power. So they just write it off because they're too wise. And they don't understand the true power of the cross is greater than any human strength. So going back to what we have talked about in the last couple of lessons, what is the theme of 1 Corinthians? What is the goal here? Paul is trying to deal with division. He's trying to deal with division, and if he is going to be successful in keeping the Corinthians from division, this is something that is going to help the Corinthians be of the same mind and judgment and no longer fighting with one another. We will only be united when a worldview that is worldly is going to be abandoned. When self-centeredness is abandoned, and when we are fully dependent on Christ, when people are fully dependent on Christ, it makes them more unified. But divisions exist and fighting continues when people want to make themselves God and think that they can call the shots. And that's not the way it should be, and it's certainly not what's good for us. We need to recognize that what is written here in 1 Corinthians really, really does apply to us today and is very helpful for us if we want to be in unity with one another, but be in unity with God, which is the most important thing. Paul was dealing with some people that were not unified, and they needed to be. So I hope these things will be useful to you and an encouragement to you. And next week we will pick up with verse 26 and talk more about Christ and what He should mean to the Corinthians and them being of one mind. If tonight you are in a situation where you are not of one mind, if for some reason you're separated from God, we don't want that to continue. If you're separated from God because you've never named the name of Jesus Christ, the cross was designed for you to take away your sins. And that sacrifice that Christ made, we come in contact with that sacrifice through baptism. If we can help you in any way, we would encourage you to come while we stand and sing.